Today is Sunday, May 8th, 2022. This is part 30 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart. Jim's last name is spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T, and my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing excellent, Tom. I hope you're doing well.
Yes, thank you. Jim, we are doing this oral history over the telephone. May we have your permission to record this oral history?
Yes, of course. Go right ahead.
Thank you. We left off, you talked quite a bit last time about how to name a butte in a national park, talked about Butchert Butte, and then to get back into the hiking theme, I believe it's a hike in the late part of 2014. Can you pick that thread up?
Yeah, sure. Again, it was a fall hike, and as your listeners know, I'm kind of relegated to the seasonal trips down from Vancouver. So this particular trip, Art and Christensen and I decided to do in mid-November of 2014. And we like to get Bruce Grubbs involved in these trips when possible, but Bruce and his partner, Dewart, had to go back to Connecticut for family business, and so it's just going to be Art and I, and we had a pretty ambitious plan, I have to say, as we always seem to at the start of a hike.
Mm.
And the trip was laid out that we were going to follow the high route from Nankweep Valley down to the Vishnu area, and then come up at the break north of Vishnu to the rim, and then walk the rim roads back to basically Saddle Mountain, and then go back down to our car at the Saddle Mountain trailhead. So along the way, we were planning to tackle a number of summits, and in particular, Coulter and Banta, possibly Jeffords, Hubble, and Vishnu. So it was pretty ambitious, because as you know, when you're doing this high route, you're basically going up and climbing the red wall, and sometimes quite a bit higher to get through the passes between the drainages. For instance, between Nankweep and Quaggint, you have to hike up there. It's not too bad. You can go up west of Hutton Butte and then drop down into Quaggint. But going in from Quaggint into Llama Creek, it's quite a stiff climb up to the rim area just southeast of Atoko Point. You have to go pretty much through all of the supai there on top of going up through the red wall. So it's it makes for long climbing, and Art actually calculated before we started on the hike that if we did the full objective, we would do 21,000 feet of climbing.
Wow.
Vertical. Yeah, it's pretty impressive. This was our ambition, and it always seems that the plans look really positive when you're starting the trip, but as you get into it, I guess the Grand Canyon is a lot bigger place than that map on the wall, and you realize, it's going to take us a little bit longer than we expected to do this. So that's kind of what happened, and we reverted to a reduced trip into Nankweep and Quaggint, but no problem. We still had a great time, and we got a few summits. So I flew into Phoenix in mid-November, and then we drove up on the 11th, I think it was, to Marble Canyon, but they were closed down essentially at that time for dinner because of the fire, right? And this was the first time I'd seen the lodge there after the fire. It was pretty...
This is the fire that burned the lodge down.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so we couldn't eat there, and we went on to Vermilion Cliffs and ate there. And they told us that they only had like another 5 or 6 days that they were going to be open. Art very strategically said, why don't we stay in the hotel tonight, instead of the plan was to head down to House Rock and camp at the car, right?
Right.
It's not the best place to camp. I mean, it's all kind of dusty and, in the PJ and whatnot. So, I mean, sitting in the hotel and relaxing in a nice bed, kind of one hands down. So that's what we elected to do. And of course, the dividend for that is that you spend longer time getting to the trailhead, right?
Right.
So we started, instead of getting up at crack of dawn and heading down Nankoweap, we didn't get there till like 9:30. And which was fine. I mean, like I say, we're not in any rush anymore to do these trips, right? We have objectives and we try to meet them, but you just kind of take it as it comes. And so we got to the saddle trailhead and started up. And I remember thinking that this trail, you know, when I first came up this trail in the early 70s, from House Rock Valley, there were stretches through the Ponderosa Pine there where there was no trail. I mean, you couldn't find it, right? You would occasionally see a switchback here or there, you know, and because there's very, very little formal trail construction. It's not that much of a slope to get up there, so it's basically long switchbacks that are laid out up the talus slopes.
Yeah.
Which are vegetated, of course, but this trip, it was very obvious that this trail now is getting a lot of use because it was easily followable the whole distance. There were no places where you would lose it and then pick it up later. So
okay.
That was just something to note and file away. And so then we headed up to the saddle there. And stashed some water for our return trip, so that we'd have, you know, when we got to the top of the plan was to come back from Vishnu along the rim on the highway, walking the road, and then get to Point Imperial and follow the rim around to the trail that drops down from the park boundary.
Yes.
To the saddle. And
right.
we figured that would be a long stretch, and we could put some water right in the saddle to get us back down to the car.
Uh-huh.
So we left some water there, a pint each. That's our standard. And then we started down, and immediately we ran into three hikers just in the little switchbacks right below the saddle there. They were coming up from below. So it was, you know, there were definitely people in the region. And so we said hi to them and then started down. And I was kind of nervous about my legs. I made notes about this in my notebook and just nervous that I was going to pull something or overdo it. So, you know, that's a long downhill stretch, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't been doing a lot of hiking, and I don't think I had at that time, you know, a few day hikes here and there to get ready for the trip, but nothing really extended with a heavy weight. And we did have 6 pounds of climbing gear with us on this trip too, because we had ropes for hauling and maybe a short rappel if we needed to, and some slings and runners and things like that. So, you know, the packs were pretty heavy, and I walked down fairly gingerly and didn't take that long. It was only about 5.5 hours, I think, to get down to the bed in Nankoweap. And when we got down there, everything was fine. So that was cool, right? I was tired, but my legs were fine. There were no issues to worry about. So that was kind of a relief because we knew that was a pretty challenging bit of walking to get down there with a heavy load. So we decided to camp right at the end, at the bottom of the trail there in the standard.
Mm-hmm.
In the standard spot, and you know we were there, and just before dark, a party of four river runners came walking through the camp, and they had been up Nankoweap Butte that day. And one of them, there was a woman in the group, a young woman, and she's walking barefoot. Now, obviously, I'm assuming she just took her sandals off, you know, just in the immediate vicinity somewhere. But she was walking barefoot through the camp, and, you know, that area is, there's sand, but there's a lot of boulders and rocks, too. So I don't know. It just struck us as kind of interesting. So this party, I guess, they had decided to take some time off because they were from the floating, because there were some record discharges being released from the dam, something like 34,000 CFS, I think,
okay,
in an effort to build up the beaches. This
right.
is what we learned from them. And I think Art had done some research on this, too. And so, you know, they had taken some days out of their schedule to just relax and do these side hikes. So
nice.
It was fun to meet them and chat with them for a few minutes. But so, anyways, the next, we got to bed reasonably early there, and you know, even in November, you don't have a whole lot of light late, and so it's easy to go to bed early.
Yeah.
And I remember we were harassed by a mouse there, but it's a fairly, you know, you expect it in that spot because
yeah.
this is where all the hikers accumulate, right?
That's
and,
right.
and hang out. So yeah, the next morning at this point, we realized we weren't gonna make, you know, the objective that we had laid out, that getting all the way to Vishnu with all those climbs, those three big climbs, you know, in the way, was probably not going to happen. So, actually, it's four big climbs, isn't it? Because you have to come up to the out of Unkar Creek to the Vishnu Saddle.
Hmm.
So at that point, we said, look, let's change up the plan here and just spend some time in Quaggan and Nanquip. I mean, it's my favorite area of the entire Grand Canyon, so it's an easy decision to make, you know. And I knew we'd still be able to get a few summits, right,
uh-huh.
if we were lucky and
yeah.
and worked hard at it. So, yeah, that sounded like a good plan. So the next morning, we kind of had a leisurely start, and we're going to head over to Quaggan. And we figured we'd go to Quaggan first and explore in that area.
Mm.
Because it's farther away, and you know, the realization was that we were going to go back up the Nanquip Trail, you know, or some option related to that, and so we decided to go down to Quaggan by going along the river, you know, and this was kind of interesting because we hadn't brought maps of that part of the canyon because we were going to be doing the high route, and so we would have, you know, we had maps for the western
right.
Part of these basins, Nanquip and Quaggan, but not the river, the river topo. So we thought that it was going to be a couple of hours to walk from Nanquip down to Quaggan, you know, and it turned out to be four, right?
Yeah.
So, but you know, it was kind of in keeping, I guess, with our relaxed alternative hike, right? So. It's not like, you know, it's not like it's disappointing, right,
right.
to be down there
it's
and spending
a beautiful
four
walk.
Hours. It is. And, you know, the river's floating by, and it was actually the rapids were quite washed out, you know.
Oh, okay.
Because of the high water
flow. Because the water was
flow.
Up. Right. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we got to Quaggan and relaxed there for a while, and then we went down and actually looked at the at the rapids, right, and,
okay.
the, and the flow there. It was quite impressive with all sorts of debris coming down and,
oh.
and well, a few logs. I shouldn't
yeah.
say all sorts of debris, but,
yeah.
You know, some detritus. And it's good for scale, and you can also see, when you see a log coming through, you get a sense of speed, right, and
yeah.
and whatnot. So it's fun to watch that stuff. And then we eventually got ready to head up Quaggan. And I was immediately, you know, right off the bat, when you leave the delta there, you're walking up the drainage, you get this fantastic view of Hutton. And I know I've talked with you about Hutton over in the past talks, you know, and ever since the hike, I went down Quaggan Creek to meet Doug Rickard in the early 70s or mid-70s to join him on a river trip, and I had gotten this fantastic view of Hutton at that time from when I was farther up the drainage. But ever since then, I've always felt that Hutton was the most, you know, neatest-looking summit in the Grand Canyon from my perspective. And I know Vishnu is, you know, cool because it's pointed and like a helmet, but Hutton just has a very elegant horn, almost a horn-like look to it. Plus, it's named for a famous geologist, right,
mm-hmm.
which,
mm-hmm.
you know, is exciting
helps.
For me. So,
yeah.
But anyways, we got this great view of Hutton, and I'm thinking, God, I got to get up Hutton someday, you know. And so anyways, we continued up Quaggan Creek, and got up to the went past the Butte Fault and then headed up to put in a camp up by, just to the west of the spring.
Okay.
In Quaggins. So it's up there. It's actually down below the east side of Dupa and Hutton in that area. So it's kind of an open area
mm-hmm.
of Quaggin Creek, and and there's reliable water there just downstream from where we camped. So it was a good base. Now, we were going to be here for a couple of days, right, because we wanted to explore in the upper part of Quaggin and also to try and climb Banta and maybe Jefford. So we figured we'd hang out there, and the next morning, so this is day three, we put our gear into our backpacks, and then we have these little day packs that we can carry on our fannies,
mm-hmm.
And so we take our day gear in that, and we started up to check out the far arm of Quaggin there, the far west arm.
Okay.
And I'd never been up all the way in that arm, and I'd like to try and, you know, get up through the red wall
right.
in these drainages. So,
right.
We started up and quite impressive. And the first thing, right, a few minutes after leaving our camp, we encountered this debris flow that had come down from between Gunther and Cochise. It came down that drainage.
Okay.
Now, I don't know if you've been hiking in there in the last 6 years or so, but this debris flow is very impressive. And when we got there, we figured it had to have happened and accumulated probably during the previous summer's monsoon downpours, because there was no vegetation anywhere on the surface of this debris flow.
Okay.
And you could follow, we did this on the way back, you could follow the debris train, the sediment,
yep.
all the way down to within like a quarter mile of the Butte Fault.
Hmm.
And that's where the last sediment
stopped.
Know, stopped.
Yep.
And right in that area there was a little tiny sprout of a plant.
Mm-hmm.
And everywhere else upstream there was no vegetation that we could see anywhere on the debris flow. And so we didn't spend a whole lot of time in there because we were heading upstream and wanted to check out the red wall in the far arm, but we could see where you could see looking up to the south there onto the north side of Cochise
mm.
and Gunther where this debris flow had originated,
mm,
you know.
Cool.
And you could also see where that side drainage joined Quaggin. There was just tremendous boulders everywhere. It was just a very impressive accumulation of debris flow sediment. So we actually went back on our next trip and spent a lot more time in there and got more detail on the debris flow. But it was pretty neat to see this because you know this is how the canyon has been formed, right?
Right?
But you rarely see
right.
these kinds of events in action, and this was still probably 3 or 4 months old or 6 months old, but it was very recent in geological time, and very cool to see that. I mean, I could have spent all day there, right, just looking at things.
Yeah.
But we had to keep going.
Have you found from that point where that debris fan is? Where that debris flow is, have you found a way south through the red wall there?
That's a good point. And the answer is no, not through the red wall. But on like I said, the next trip that we did, or maybe it's two trips later, I can't recall. We'll have to review the notes on that. But we decided that we wanted to go, our trip at that point entailed, our plan was to go up out of Nanquip and over, up out of Quaggin and over into Char Creek using a notch just east of Cochise.
Okay.
And so this is the valley of that debris flow, and you walk up that valley,
mm-hmm.
and from the bed of Quaggin, it looks so enticing.
Yes.
to be able to get up through that. And so on this subsequent trip, which I can go into more detail later on another day, we did just that. We went up there, and we found our way up very steep talus, and we walked all the way. We got right up to within under the base of the red wall there, and, mm-hmm. and there's an overhang.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah. So we couldn't make it up that. And
all right. Well, I won't try again.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's possible that there may be, you know, if you go like
a little further west.
I can't see going to the west of Cochise. I can't see that until of course you get way over to the main drain, the main transit point. But you know, you might be able to go up on the northeast side of Gunther.
Yes.
It's more broken there, yep. And then if you could do that, then you could drop down pretty easily.
Yeah, okay.
But to get back to where, you know, to our trip here.
Yes.
So we passed the mouth of the debris flow, where it joins Quaggan Creek, and we started, you know, we continued up the valley, and we got to the drainage that comes down from west of Banta Point, and basically it's the drainage that you go up to climb up towards the Toco Point if you're going to go down into Unkar, right? And so, into Char. And it's the standard route there, and there's a water pocket in there in the tapetes, and so every time we're in the area we check it out to see if there's water in there, and there always is. It's extremely reliable. There's always been water there in the 6 or 7 times I've checked it out. So this is it's right in the tapetes, and you walk up the drainage. About 5 minutes, 6 minutes, and normally if you're going to climb up to the top of the red wall here, or actually the supai up this drainage, you will climb out of the drainage just inside the mouth of it on River Right or Creek Right.
Mm-hmm.
There's a break there to get you through the tapetes. But to get to the water, you just continue up the bed of the drainage, and you get to a short dry fall, and you can scramble up that, and this water pocket is in there, and it's really very well protected. It's totally in shade. You can see,
nice.
And it's one of these buckets that's really deep. It's been, you know, through erosion, it's been dug down quite a bit, and so there's a lot of capacity in there. And so we checked it again, and there it was. It was plenty of water for drinking and full of leaves and whatnot, but kind of reassuring, you know, to know it's there.
Yeah.
And so then we continued up the red wall drainage there. And so what we're trying to do now is go up to as high as we can in the drainage of Quaggan that's between Etoko Point and Tridal Peak. And I'd heard rumors that Jim Ullman had been up through there, had gotten through the red wall there. And I didn't know specifically what the route details were. But we started up, and one of the first things we noticed when we got into the red wall was another recent rock fall where a huge fin of red wall had collapsed and left a giant scar and associated debris beneath it. You know, another very impressive reminder of that the canyon is constantly growing and expanding and aging. So it was kind of neat to see that. But you continue up, and there's lots. You know, it's a really fun hike because there's all sorts of little obstacles to get around. You know, little cliffs and boulders and things like that. And we kept going up and up and up. And I was so excited to think that we were going to get another red wall route. And then. Just at the very top, we're in the main drainage, and it's blocked.
Wow.
And I thought, oh well, this is unfortunate. So we backtracked a little way, and then we could see a route that scrambled up some cliffs on the south side of the drainage, the south side of the arm of the drainage that we were in, and you could see that there was possibilities of scrambling, steep, high-angled slope, right? Not slope, but face.
Okay.
And we're looking at the clock, and we're just saying, you know, it's getting really late. And so we decided to turn around there rather than try it. And so I understand, I looked into this afterwards. I think I talked with Jim about it, and he said, yes, he had gotten through there, you know, a long time ago, back in the 70s. And so it was, you know, it entailed some scrambling and, and phase climbing and, and whatnot. So it is a route.
Okay.
And and the neat thing is that Art had also seen when we were coming up from below, he had noticed that the drainage through the red wall that comes down directly from north of Atoko Point looked very promising as a route. And if and this is confirmed in Green's book written with Ullman, right?
Yep.
This route's confirmed. So I've, you know, got a plan here. The next time I'm on the north rim with a day to kill, you know, this would be a great little day hike to drop down the route from near Greenland Lake, west of Atoko Point. You could drop all the way down into the through the red wall. Come, you know, if you can make the climb that we turned around at, and then come up this little drainage, and then follow that would bring you right up to the base of the Coconino below Atoko Point, and then follow that around and get back out. Nice little day hike for a fall trip in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Right. So. Yeah, you see, you're going to have to start a book now, Day Hikes from the Rim.
No, that's your job.
Okay. So, anyways, you know, a fun day, a really fun day. We didn't make it through the red wall, but you know, it was a really beautiful setting. There's all sorts of, you know, spruce up in there and in these red wall clefts, you know, on the
north-facing slope.
Yeah, it's just really, really beautiful, and a little trickle of water, and so it was
super.
Really a special spot. So we headed back down, and had quite a walk to get back down to our camp, but no problem, we made it down there, and then had another night. The weather was kind of threatening in the evening, so we had Art's tarp up, and I recall that I seemed to sleep underneath it, and then he would stay out, and once I think he got caught and had to scramble in, but anyways, a nice, but the nights were cold, so that was, you know, interesting. It was when it wasn't raining, it was pretty chilly. It was down sometimes sub-zero, so it was certainly chilly.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, again, we're hanging out in Quaggan, and the plan this time was to do Banta. So this is a Banta point is a red wall point that is found on the south side of Quaggan Valley.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just a projection at the end of a ridge. And it is separated from the rest of the ridge by a notch. And so we didn't really know, I didn't know anything about the route up Manta at the time. So I just figured it probably went up from that notch. So Art and I started back up Quaggan in the morning. And got to the drainage that comes down between Banta and Jeffords and hiked up that a short distance, and then worked our way up through the Tapetes, and then worked up towards Banta Point directly.
Hmm.
And so it was a fairly straightforward for a forward walk, and Art at one point, I mean, Art decided he wasn't going to go ahead with the climb.
Okay.
So, you know, I made a plan to meet with him down in the drainage, and we would decide then, after I climbed Banta, what we would do, whether we'd go up Jeffords or what. So he hung out down by the Tapetes while I continued on up, and, so it's pretty neat. You get to, have you climbed Banta?
No.
No, okay. This is one you can do from the river. It's just it will be a long day, but you could do it. And you just basically head for the point, and then you walk around the south side of it, the red wall mass there, and there's a very steep talus slope that goes up to this notch between the point and the ridge to the southwest. And the deer go up this. You could see, when I was in there, you could see the deer tracks going up this very, very steep talus. And kind of like, you know, the red wall fragments that would almost start to slide, you know, as you walked up. So you had to be fairly gingerly there on the talus. But a very pretty spot when you get to that notch. Because you have, you know, there's just a notch in this red wall ridge, and you can, you know, you got tremendous views to the north and the south, and there's a couple of ponderosa pines sitting there, you know, and they're kind of gently blowing in the breeze, and little grassy slopes ledges of red wall limestone. Really pretty spot. Yeah, I could see why the deer would go up there and hang out.
Yeah.
You know. And so anyways, from there, I didn't spend too much time there because I wanted to get up this thing. And so I walked horizontally because right at the notch, there's no way to get up. And so I walked horizontally hoping that there'd be a break. And there was at the east end of this horizontal traverse. There was an interesting little third-class scramble. And I thought, oh, okay, well, that's it. That's it. I've got it made. You know, it's just a piece of cake from here. And so then I followed up a little bit farther, and there's another head wall. And I'm looking and I'm thinking, well, this is looking a little more touchy, you know. And it turns out there is a way to go, and it's fairly straightforward, but it's very steep. You know, it's pretty much vertical for about 30 feet with good holds. And the clincher is that right at the top of this face, there's a pinion sitting there.
Huh.
And, you know, with a big limb that is right where you have to be, right where you have to go. And, but, you know, I figured it was a savings, right? Because if anything was going to go wrong, there was that big limb to grab onto, right? So it was no big deal. And actually that helped me going down.
Cool.
Because I could just, I just held onto the limb and lowered down, right? That last stretch.
Nice.
Anyways, the point is that it was a very intriguing third class. And when I got to the top of it, it was like, wow, that was cool. You know, the adrenaline's flowing, right? And, But in the back of your mind, you're thinking, well, I also got to get down that. So I then scrambled up to the top, and there was a cairn there, but I didn't find any registers. So, you know, I remember thinking at the time that it's a fairly flat summit for a small area, and you know, you get this red wall detritus, I guess, that weathers out on the surface, and you know, it's like little chips of limestone with sand and algae growing on it and whatnot. And you know, if you step on that, it leaves a footprint, right? It's very obvious. And you know, we try to minimize making tracks on that surface as much as we can.
Right.
You know, obviously, you can't do it all the time, but I do remember seeing what I thought were like bovine prints, you know. Deer or sheep or something like that. And I just can't believe that the sheep came up what I came up. So there may be an easier way, you know. On the other hand, these may not have actually been tracks. They weren't that well preserved.
Oh,
so
okay.
It was just something that that I noted at the time and you know, just...
Well, the sheep will go wherever you go.
Yeah, I know. But this was a vertical face for about 25, 30 feet. I don't know. Anyways,
they'll do it. If you can do it, they'll do it. They have four hands. Well,
that's just true. Yeah, you're right.
They're pretty spiky.
Yeah, I got to give them the credit. Yep. So, yeah, that's why we saw sheep up on top of Quaggan Butte there, you know?
Yep.
No, I'm joking about that.
No, okay.
Okay, I didn't. Right. We didn't actually see sheep up there or sheep prints, but I'm not saying that they didn't get up there. So.
Quaggan, How would they have done that? You know, I and you would lead me on for a while, and I just think, well, there's a route up Quaggan we just don't know about.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and if you look at like Quaggan from the desert facade, you know, the Palisades of the desert on the east side of the river,
yeah.
And you look at the face that would be like at the east end of Quaggan.
Mm-hmm.
It is broken there, and I swear I've been over there on the east side of the river on the platform with binoculars.
Wow.
And you're looking at that, and you're thinking, "Wow, you know, be fun to go check that out."
Maybe
you don't know.
Yeah.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So, anyways, let's just grist for another hike.
Yes.
But so, anyways, I started back down from that point, and I could see that Art was down in the drainage waiting for me, and he had come up the bed when I had kind of traversed directly up to the butte, and oh, I didn't actually talk about coming down, and obviously it was uneventful, right? But it was a little interesting when I got to that down climb and had to lower down, right? But the holds were all there, and I knew where they were, so it was really not any problem. And again, you know, the exhilaration of completing it and knowing at that point that all the objective hazards were done with is really a good experience. So. But anyways, I headed down then to touch base with Art, and I'm looking at Jeffords, because Jeffords is across the valley, right? And Jeffords is another point of red wall that you can actually come up from below the way I was trying to do, or you can come down to Jeffords Point from the Siegfried Pyre area and Atoko Point if you want to follow the red wall rim around, right? So it's one of these summits where you can get to it by hiking, or you can, if you come from above, or, you know, if you want to do some more technical scrambling, you can come up from below. So that's what I was trying to do, but it's kind of getting late in the afternoon, and at this point, and I couldn't see any obvious route. And so when I joined Art down in the bed of the gully or the drainage, I said, no, I don't think Jeffords is going to happen today. So we passed off, you know, passed on that one, and then started down the drainage and back to our camp. So,
okay.
So you know, it was a good day to get that one summit,
yeah.
And very exciting and exhilarating. So it's one of my favorites, I have to say.
Hmm.
It really is of all that I've done. It's
cool.
It's really up there. I guess because of the technical aspect of it. So yeah, at this point, then we kind of had exhausted our time in Quaggan, and we did camp another night then in the same spot. This would be the third night that we camped there. I don't think I've camped any place in the Grand Canyon, any other place, for three nights. You know, it's pretty unusual, but it was a nice spot, and the next morning we got down and we figured, well, we're not going back up river to get into the Nankwe. We're going to take the horse thief trail,
okay,
or its variants. And so we headed down and again following the trace of this debris flow as far as we could, and then it finally disappears. And then we got to the area where the Butte Fault bisects the terrain there.
Right.
And we because we didn't have the maps, we got a little off in where we were, and we started up the drainage that is basically the one that goes right up along the uplift.
Okay.
And we didn't want to do that because we wanted to go west to Nankwe Butte, and that's uh-huh. one of our favorite hikes, I think. So we had to backtrack and get into the right drainage, and then it was no big deal to just follow the drainage and then ultimately the slopes. And I think we've talked about this hike before, and I think maybe you've done it, but it basically you hike up and the shale slopes to west of Nankwe Butte. There's
right.
a nice saddle there, and I'm looking at a picture right now that Art took, and he blew it up and mounted it on foam board, and it's a picture of me walking across this saddle, you know, in the foreground, there are all these weathered stones that are just sitting there, surrounded by reddish sand, reddish-yellow sand. And then, of course, in the background, you see this tremendous view of Saddle Mountain and Hayden and all sorts of things, right? It's one of the most spectacular places in the entire Grand Canyon,
cool.
I think. But this this saddle is so impressive because it impressed us so much because the way you see these rocks that are sitting in the saddle, and keep in mind that the rocks are sitting there and the wind is always blowing the sand around them, right? And so they're kind of half buried in there, but these rocks looked exactly like the photos that were coming from the Mars rover.
Oh, wow.
Around that time, you know. And I just remember seeing the rover was, you know, going around doing its thing and the red Martian surface, you know, and then these rocks that are sitting there I'm spending a lot of time describing this, but it just was so evocative of those images, you know, the view that you see when you go through this saddle. So it's just a spectacular place, and it's an easy way to get to Nankwe Butte.
Yes.
So I really recommend anybody that's in the area to hike up there and spend some time up there. So, that's the way we went up, and then we came down, heading into Nankwe Creek, and that's like the easiest hike in the entire Grand Canyon to walk down that drainage because it's like a 5-degree slope, and it's just fine shale chips the entire way, because the whole area there of Nankwe Butte and the slope around it is in, I think, the 60-mile formation, the Precambrian 60-mile, and it's just basically underlain by this very extensive shales that weather out to very fine chips and plates, and so they just form these very gentle pavements of sand, and it's so easy to walk. Now I can see why that woman was walking in sandals in that part of it, because walking barefoot, because it would be a piece of cake there, right? So there's the occasional fallen juniper that blocks your way that you have to climb around, and there's some willow thickets and things like that, but you know, the overall impression is it's a very, very cool hike in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
So simple, you know, such straightforward walking. So always a pleasure to go to hike through there, right? So we followed that drainage down and basically got to the bed of Nankwe, you know, fairly late in the day. And our plan for the next day was to try and climb Coulter. So we did hike upstream up Nankwe Creek and to just below, there's a big spring there with willow thickets and grapevine thickets. And this is just below the drainage that comes down between Coulter and Swilling. So we found the camp spots are kind of tough in that area, but we did find a spot just downstream from that side drainage on River Wright. So we set up there for the night and had an uneventful evening. Pretty tired, I'm sure. But the next day, again, was for Coulter, and we were thinking that this would be probably a fairly long day, and we were right on that for sure. So the way we started up was the way that Bruce and Art and I had originally gone up to Swilling and Dupa many, many years prior, and that is to go up the instead of following the drainage that directly, you go up the open talus on the west side of that drainage. It was fine once you got up there, but the problem is we just tackled it in the wrong place, and we got hung up in this grapevine and willow thicket that's in the area. And it's really extensive and long. It's about 200 meters, I think. I've been there enough times now that I know exactly where to go to avoid it.
Right.
But without that information, you know, it's easy to get mixed up, and that's what happened to us this time. And I remember just there were places where I was having to just lean over with all my body weight to try and crash through this stuff,
geez.
You know. Just horrible. What a terrible way to start your hike, you know, for the day. But anyways, it was over in a few minutes, and we finally got through it. but and then could continue up the open slope there. And it's fairly straightforward, right? Not just a beautiful shale slope with pinyon junipers and the occasional big Tapete boulder that's rolled down from above. And so eventually we got up high enough that we were walking along the base of the Tapete, and we Art and I actually missed somehow the route that Bruce and Art and I had found like 10 years prior when we went through there the first time. And so we kind of unfortunately missed that, and it was too bad because that's a much better way if you can find that. It diminishes or reduces the amount of brush you have to go through. So as we're walking along the base of this Tapete cliff looking for a route, you know, it's getting brushier and brushier, and trees are hemming us in. And so anyway, slow going, but we finally found another break through the cliff closer to the main drainage, and worked our way up there. And so at this point, the hiking gets pretty easy because you're just climbing the open slopes of pinyon juniper below Swilling and Coulter Butte, and heading up through the through a nice little valley there. And the route goes up a fairly gentle climb until you get to the red wall itself. And at that point, you know, we dropped our packs because we knew day packs because we had some fairly serious walking ahead of us. And so right from the notch there's a gully, and Harvey had been up this in the 60s. I think he attempted to climb Coulter, and he and his colleagues at the time got into this gully, and they described going up this face on the west side of the gully, and it's fairly confined in there. It's only, the gully is maybe 8 or 10 feet across, okay. Right? And we're looking at this face, and we're saying, really? You know, God, Harvey, man, he really had the drive. And so we're looking at it, and eventually, we just decided, no, forget it, right? But at that point, I said, well, look, you know, it looks like we can just go up the gully itself, right?
Right.
And so I said, I'll lead up there and just see what's up there, right? So I actually trailed a rope, the rope that we had, and was able to chimney up this up the back of the gully. And then at the top, there was a place you had to swing out of the chimney and on big holes, right, and grab some big holes and then pull yourself up. And there was a very conveniently placed pinion there, too, that I could just put a runner around and actually protect it, right, if anything happened. There was nothing going to happen because it was so straightforward, but it was still nice to have that assurance, right? So, anyways, we get up there, and then I blade Art up, and we're thinking that we had it made, and it turns out there's even more climbing ahead of you. So there's more red wall that you have to scramble up. Nothing technical, right? Nothing serious, but lots of back and forth walking through the supai to try and work your way up through the breaks in the cliffs.
Right.
And I think you've been up Coulter, right?
No.
Oh, okay, sorry.
But the supai is the same everywhere. You got to go back and forth trying to find the way to get through it.
Oh, yeah, very, very, very typical. And that's what makes it so much fun.
Mm.
But eventually, you know, and we basically circumnavigated the whole thing, spiraling up.
Huh.
And to get to the summit. And the summit, it turns out, is it's like rabbit ears, two blocks of supai that are sheer, about 12 feet high from the notch between the two of them. And the higher one is the southerly one, and I scrambled up into the notch between the two blocks, and I'm looking at the face to climb this block, and I just kind of said, no, you know, this is not, I'm not going to do this without protection and some sort of assist. And so we said, well, you know, we could throw the rope over the top, and because we did have a thin line with us, and we could prussic up, right?
Uh-huh.
Or free climb with a prussic safety.
Yeah.
And but then we started thinking, you know, it's getting pretty late, and we're pretty far from our camp. So we, you know, the way we rationalized it was, it was simply an engineering task that we had to do to get to the summit, the actual summit. And we could have done that had we had the time,
right.
But we elected to not do it. So, you know, I basically had my hands more or less on the top of Coulter Butte, but I never actually stood on it. So it was, you know,
close enough.
One of those bittersweet moments,
yeah.
But I just assume that I've climbed it because I did 99.9% of the work to get there. So, anyways, that was a very exciting day for both of us, and we did rappel the two red wall climbs on the way back down to save time, right? And and then when we got farther down the slopes below the red wall, we just stayed in the drainage, and there's a nice a little cliff of 60-mile formation sandstone that cuts across that valley, and it diverts you out of the bed, but there's a nice deer trail that follows along the top of it, and then you get down and anyways, it's just a fun little ending to the day. So back to our camp, and by the time we got there, it was totally dark. You know, we were using headlamps to get back into the camp. So pretty long day, as it turns out. And it's kind of interesting because if you look at it on the map, it's actually one of the shortest distance-wise that we did on all this hiking, this entire trip. But it just had a lot of thinking and back and forth effort to work things out.
Yeah.
So at that point it was pretty much the end of the trip. You know that, you know, you've only got one day left to get out, and we actually did have another day available, and the idea was to go up into the northwest arm of Nankoweap. But I was just thinking that given our position at the lower end of Nankoweap, and you know, the fact that I want to do these hikes right, and when I say that I mean I want to get up as far as I can, right?
Yes.
And that usually takes a fair amount of time, so we figured that it was probably better to depart the next day rather than spending the final day doing something that we would only get half accomplished. So
right.
So in the morning then we got our packs up and put them on and started up the Nankoweap Trail. And, you know, I kept track of my times. I always keep track of the times, but I reviewed them here when I was, you know, planning for this chat today. And it was damn fast. I mean, I was impressed, you know. An hour and 25 minutes to get from the top of the Tapetes to the top of the Red Wall.
Wow.
That's not bad, you know, with big packs. And so, anyways, it did take us much of the day to get back to the saddle, and we were thinking at the time that, you know, this was one of our slowest efforts ever, and we were really tired, and we were getting to be old men, and you know, we had to reconsider how we were going to be doing these hikes in the future. And so when I got home, each of us did this independently and then talked about it later. We did review our old notes, and we found out that, you know, we did this as fast as any other trip, right?
Oh, cool.
It's just that for some reason we had this psychological experience of being fatigued and tired and whatnot, that kind of overrode the logic of keeping, you know, of the timing of it, right? The timing was actually fast, but we just felt it more, I guess.
Yeah.
So, anyways, it worked. Everything worked out fine in the end. We had a great trip. We got to the saddle and our water, you know, that we had left for drinking to get back to the car was all frozen. So that was of no value to us. So, but we didn't really need it. That's mostly for emergency. And and had an uneventful walk back down to the car, and then headed on out to Vermilion Cliffs for supper.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that was that hike in November of 2014. And
nice.
Another a great one in my memory, for sure.
Yeah. And the Quagga and Nickweed, those ranges are big, and it's easy to spend a lot of time there.
It is. It is. And I think there's just so much to be seen, you know. I mean, there's the waterfalls. There's the arches and bridges, you know. There's so many summits to be had.
Yep.
Some easy, and then some very technical, you
yeah.
know. And occasional ruins here and there.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and again, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the spruce fir forest that drops down, spills
yes.
off the north rim.
Yes.
Sometimes goes right down to into the redwall.
Right,
you know?
A ways down, yeah.
Yeah, and so you have these magnificent trees just sitting down there in amongst these beautiful red cliffs, and everything is just moaning gently in the wind, you know.
Nice.
It's really a spectacular place to go. So I hope I get another 25 years of hiking in there.
There you go. There you go.
Yeah. So.
All right. Is there anything else about this hike you want to bring in?
I don't think so. I mean, I covered the high points there, and you know, I did tell you that somewhat revealing little story at the end about being tired, you know, at the end of the trip, and questioning whether you're going to be able to keep this up. But anyways, you know, these things kind of, I guess, continually go through my mind these days all the time, right? And because I'm 68 now.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, this was, you were 60 on that hike. It was eight years ago, so.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I still haven't lost the drive.
Right.
And, you know, I'm going to give you, in the next couple of weeks, a couple more great hikes, you know,
yes.
that were extremely demanding. So it's not like the capacity's gone, but
right.
but it is being definitely looking at things in a different perspective. You know?
That's right. That's right.
So
yeah. Well, it's how time turns us.
It does.
Yeah.
Yes, and slowly we have to adapt.
That's right.
So
that's right.
And I actually think now quite a bit about people like Harvey Butcher, you know, who spent much more time than I ever will hiking in the Grand Canyon, and you know how he must have approached or dealt with this time turning phenomenon, you know, as
yes.
he got older and found that he couldn't keep up with the young guys, whereas he used to be way out ahead of them, you
right.
know, and you know, what kind of thoughts ran through his head, you know. Is it like, well, maybe this is my last hike, you know, maybe I shouldn't do this anymore, or, oh, no, I got one more in me, or, you know, just
yeah.
interesting things to think about, right?
Slow and steady.
There you go.
Yep. Yep.
There you go.
Yeah. All right, well, with that, this will conclude part 30, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, May 8th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin, and Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate you sitting around listening to me tell these tales.
It's always enjoyable.